K06-1013, David Burnett versus LFW Incorporated. Good morning, Mr. Wortman.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. Brad Wortman and Peter Angelkovich on behalf of Mr. David Burnett, plaintiff in this case. Judge, I want to emphasize where this case comes from. The appeal here is the appeal of a memorandum decision on a motion for summary judgment. And I think one of the appropriate things to do is take a look at the parties' versions of the facts and just looking at the difference in their portrayal of the facts. This case truly does scream out as a genuine issue of material fact. With due respect to the trial court, we do believe that there were some very serious facts or material facts in this case that were disregarded. This isn't a case of Mr. Burnett simply telling his employer, I'm sick, I want to go home. There is a chronology of events that begins as early as October of 2003, where he complains of symptoms that are similar to prostate cancer, frequent urination. He needs to be near a bathroom. And it goes on and on and on at almost weekly intervals. They're getting more and more notice of what is taking place. I do note that there are two critical documents in this case that have been given by Mr. Burnett to his supervisor and to Mr. Polo. First of which is marked as plaintiff's or Polo's Exhibit 7. Now, there's not much said with regard to this document, but it is a critical document in this case. It's very detailed and identifies a prostate ultrasound and biopsy. It indicates that he's going to have this procedure on January 27, 2004. Now, if there was any question from anyone in terms of what a PSA test was, the answer is found in the description of the procedure. In the second sentence of the procedure section, it states, indications for the examination of an abnormal rectal exam or an elevation of a prostate cancer screening prostate cancer screening blood test, PSA. Now, there was a lot of evidence presented by the defense in this case on a motion for summary judgment, which in essence argued that he didn't know, Polo, the terminating person here, didn't know what a PSA test was, or a high elevated PSA. Didn't know what that was. This document certainly undermines that. And again, we're not dealing with an issue that's been decided by a jury. The question here is whether or not there was sufficient notice to advise the employer that there was a serious medical condition. This document certainly should be enough to indicate that A, that there is a high PSA, and B.
Which document?
It's Polo Exhibit 7. It's attached just after.
Is it Burnett 7?
It would be just after the complaint, Your Honor, I believe. As part of the appendix in our brief. I believe it's the judge's opinion. There's two Burnett exhibits.
Okay.
And following
this
the complaint.
That's 7 deposition exhibit. Okay.
Now, I would also like to point to the court the document that follows Polo Exhibit 7. Again, this was given, this document I believe was given to Mr. Herr, the supervisor, on January 7th of 2004. Following document, if there was any question whatsoever on whether or not they knew what this gentleman was suffering from, is answered in the next exhibit, Polo Exhibit 16. If you look at the lower right-hand portion of that document, there's a stamp from Mr. Polo, January 28th, 2004. The very next page indicates the treatment plan from his biopsy of January 27th. It states, following a biopsy of the prostate, and gives the instructions in terms of what should follow and the complications that will follow from that procedure. It indicates there may be difficulty urinating, blood. More importantly, it also states, avoid heavy lifting and strenuous activity. Now, again, this clearly is notice to Mr. Polo. If there was any doubt whether or not he received the prior document, his own stamp says he's got this notice of the serious medical condition. Now, Mr. Polo conceded in his deposition He did not concede that he knew what a PSA test, more importantly, said with regard to that, whether or not he had been advised by Mr. Burnett of a high PSA. He says, I don't think it happened, but I can't say for sure, pages 101 and 102 of his deposition. I don't think it happened, but I can't say for sure.
Tell me this. If the employer would have terminated Mr. Burnett for insubordination, regardless of the results of his prostate cancer testing, could Mr. Burnett still bring these claims? In other words, if the employer had an independent, legitimate reason to terminate Mr. Burnett, would that extinguish the FMLA and ADA claims?
I can't necessarily answer that because in this situation, they directly tied what they classified as insubordination, protected activity that Congress has said Mr. Burnett can engage in. I want to go home. I need the time off because of a very serious issue. I mean, it's everyone would agree that kind of test result is a very serious medical condition. And more importantly, he's advised, and I do want to point this out, he's advised to avoid heavy lifting and strenuous activity. When he shows up to work on January 28th, he says, I need assistance. He's doing janitorial duties, moving doors. His supervisor told him, try to do it alone and see what happens. He announces, I'll do my best and go up and see what can happen. The next day he shows up, he still doesn't have assistance, and he's going to go through strenuous activity. I think Congress, when it enacted the Family Medical Leave Act, envisioned this kind of time off. It's a very serious condition. And I don't think the employer carries its day in court when it comes in and says, well, yeah, he might have given this notice, but I didn't know about it. I didn't receive it. I don't know what a PSA is. He does know what a biopsy is. And if there was any doubt on how serious that medical condition was, it's answered in the discharge instruction where it says biopsy for prostate. He conceded in his deposition a father-in-law of his had undergone a biopsy, and that was used for determining cancer. More importantly, the colloquy that occurs on January 29th. Again, our version of what was said is vastly different than what the defense's version of what was said. It wasn't just simply, I'm sick. One of the most important statements that was recollected in that conversation was by Mr. Burnett, where Mr. Polo said, if you're talking about that note of January 27th, it's not important. So with that statement, we would suggest that a jury could conclude he knows of this condition, and he took it upon himself, in violation of the regulations, to say that it is not important. It is not important that you are going through this condition, and it's not important that you receive your time off. And if you leave for exercising your family medical leave right, we're going to terminate you. I think it's very important that the court understand that just because an employer characterizes some conduct as insubordination doesn't necessarily mean that it is insubordination. This was an individual exercising his rights as provided by the United States Congress. And we would suggest, Your Honor, the evidence certainly is sufficient to indicate that they knew what they were doing in this case. The one final significant fact in this case that I think has been somewhat overlooked so far is the backdating of the letter of termination. Mr. Polo sends out a letter of termination dated February 2nd, 2004, and backdates it to effective termination date of January 30th, 2004.
You know you're in your rebuttal, don't you?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just want to point that out. The backdating is a very significant issue, and I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Fowler.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Fowler. I represent the employer, commonly known as the Habitat Company. Plaintiff in this case is asking the court to adopt a relatively novel theory, and a theory which this court has explicitly refused to adopt. The plaintiff is asking that in order to determine whether he gave sufficient notice to give the employer the idea that he may be suffering from a serious health condition, that the court looked back over a four-month period, and that this court has not done, nor am I aware that any court has done. In fact, the Collins case, which we've cited. The plaintiff had previously told the employer that she was suffering from depression, and the court said that saying, in this instance, I'm sick, not only withheld important information from the employer, but likely threw it off the scent. In the Johnson versus Primerica case, which is Southern District of New York, 1996, we've cited in the brief, the court said, quote, nothing in the FMLA or the governing regulations, however, suggests that an employer's duty to inquire may be triggered solely by the employer's knowledge of prior medical events.
See, but here you argue that it would be a very different case if Mr. Burnett had gone to Polo and had said, I need a couple of weeks off because I had my weak bladder checked out, and they diagnosed me as having a high PSA level, which is an indicator of prostate cancer. I just had a prostate biopsy, and I am worried that I have cancer. And I think that the reply brief pretty well laid out the ways in which Mr. Burnett did convey all of the same information. Now, he did not convey it as eloquently as a lawyer might, but it seems to me that it is all there.
What he didn't do, Judge, is do it at the time of the request for the leave. Plaintiff's argument is that he made all of these statements over almost a four-month period. Accepting that theory would require that every supervisor effectively maintain a file. Every time this supervisor gets a piece of medical information concerning an employee, this supervisor must then put that piece of information, no matter how arcane, no matter how remote, no matter how minor, into this file so that if something comes up later, the supervisor can then go back to the file and see, well, does all of this taken in its totality refer to this particular incident, and does this rise to the level of putting them on notice? Under the FMLA notice requires three things. It requires a communication to the employer that the person is unable to work, one. Two, that they is unable to work because of a condition, medical condition or psychological condition. And three, that the condition is requiring ongoing treatment or hospitalization. In this case, even when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, even if you did go back to the four-month period, it doesn't rise to that level because none of the information that Mr. Burnett provided showed that he was being treated. The most it showed was that he was being tested. None of the information over that period shows that he was unable to work. Instead, it was a matter of choice. And when you look at specifically what he told the supervisor on the critical day, January 29th of 2004, it's on pages 186 and 187 of his deposition. Then what happened? Referring to 10:30 in the morning when he met Mr. Polo at the time clock. Answer, I repeated to Sergio I was sick. Question, what exactly did you say to Sergio? Answer, I was sick. Question, anything else? Answer, no, I wanted to go home. Question, did you tell him how you were sick? Answer, no. Question, what else did you say to Sergio? Answer, I'm just repeating I was sick. Question, what did he say to you? Answer, well, he said, if I've been referring to that note from 12704, it's not important. Question, what else did he say? Answer, and I said, well, it's important to me. I said, I'm not going to sit here and argue with you.
You're glossing over that note, and that note explained that an elevated PSA means elevation of a prostate cancer screening test. And wouldn't that notify a reasonable employer that he was having a biopsy of the prostate, which carried some risks in and of itself? I believe he also, at that time, compared his illness to that of his brother-in-law, who had prostate cancer. And didn't he express despair and concern that he would be bedridden and unable to care for himself and, you know, basically would want to commit suicide? I mean,
a couple of different conversations, Judge. The reference to his brother-in-law comes up in plaintiff's brief, and that arguably occurred on the January 26th grievance meeting. But plaintiffs testified in his deposition specifically that, question, on page 250 of his deposition, question, Did you bring up the situation with your brother-in-law? Answer, no, I don't think so. He did not raise the situation with his brother-in-law. There's certainly some references to it that he was thinking about it, but that's not what he communicated.
Well, didn't Mr. Polo also testify that before firing Burnett, he probably knew that a biopsy was a test for prostate cancer?
Yes, Judge, he did. But again, the issue is whether on the 29th of January 2004, Mr. Burnett communicated three things. Whether he communicated that he was unable to work, and he did not do that. All he said was I was sick, and there was no other medical information saying that he was unable. And there still is no medical information saying that he was unable to work on the 29th because of high PSA levels or anything else.
Well, why didn't Habitat reconsider Burnett's termination when it learned shortly after that that he indeed suffered from prostate cancer during a pertinent time period? Isn't that contrary to the policy behind FMLA?
Because by that time, Judge, as the question was asked earlier, whether if they did not know whether there would still be an action under the FMLA or the ADA. And the answer is really clear. Where there's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason or non-retaliatory reason for a job action, the action dies. There is no retaliation claim. There is no ADA claim unless where there is a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the action. Here, there is no question that Mr. Burnett engaged in insubordinate conduct, not only on the 29th when he had the conversation with Mr. Polo personally at the time clock, but on the very next day when Mr. Polo called him to say, what happened yesterday? What's going on? And Mr. Burnett hung up on him twice. In dealing with a circumstance, in dealing with a situation where an employee is engaged in admittedly insubordinate conduct, and I don't say he admitted insubordination, I say that he admitted the conduct, which is clearly insubordination. When he engages in that kind of conduct, the FMLA does not require employers to reinstate him. In fact, the cases that we've cited go so far as to show. In fact, this court's decision.
But when you go back to the conversation with Polo where he says that the report that he, I mean, the fact that he is having that test is not important, and he makes that comment a couple times, when you're looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, I mean, isn't that a part of, could be the reason that he did not engage in any conversation with the supervisor? I mean, don't we have
even
a
in the
triable
light,
issue?
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
In the light most favorable to the plaintiff, Judge, Mr. Polo's statement was absolutely true. Because the note, all the note said is Mr. Burnett had an appointment and kept his appointment on the 27th. He worked without incident on the 28th. There was no issue. He testified in his deposition and both by affidavit that there was no issue with his work performance on the 28th. On the morning of the 29th, he worked. There was no issue. Counsel said that he was concerned that he would be required to exceed his limitations on the 29th and that's why he was leaving. There's no evidence of that whatsoever in the record. The idea here is that this employer was faced with an employee who was being insubordinate. This employer was faced with an employee who wouldn't talk to him, wouldn't tell him why he was leaving. The FMLA sets out a balancing approach. As this court said in the Aubuchon case, as I recall, 2004, the FMLA is designed as a quid pro quo, as a balance between competing interests. Congress could have said, look, if somebody's got a serious health condition, people are allowed to take the time off anytime, anywhere they want, regardless of whether they can work and regardless of what notice they provide. But that's not what Congress did. Congress said they're allowed to take time off when they're unable to work and when they provide sufficient information to the employer showing that they are unable to work because of a serious health condition. Mr. Burnett did not do that. Because he didn't do that, his FMLA interference claim must fail, and because he did not provide sufficient notice to the employer to show that they, in fact, knew of a disability or of cancer as opposed to the possibility that it was being treated for it. I see my time is up. May I conclude very briefly?
Sure.
Because he didn't provide that information, we would respectfully ask that the court affirm the district court in all its respects.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler.
Thank you, Judge.
I think there's something important that was said by counsel. Counsel suggested that Mr. Burnett was obligated to advise his employer at the time that he left on January 29th cite to the Collins case that counsel cites to. Collins case facts are much different. Judge Easterbrook said that that was all she said, that she was sick. We certainly have a difference in factual situation with this. But I do want to point out, Judge Easterbrook, at the end of that opinion, states that had the employee given sufficient notice that the depression was going to cause intermittent leave, then when depression incapacitated her on a particular day, she could have made clear that the serious nature of the condition by referring to knowledge already in the employer's possession. Once the employer has knowledge, there's nothing incumbent upon Ms. Burnett to keep saying, I'm suffering from this, this, and this.
Yes, the employer had knowledge of examinations and tests, if I recall, not the diagnosis.
The employer's knowledge was in connection with the testing.
That's right. Not
that's correct.
The diagnosis.
There had not been an official diagnosis at that point. But
so the, well,
I'm sorry.
Follow through. He'd have to accept the fact that he'd have to take the worst possible prognosis on the test, wouldn't it?
Certainly acknowledge the fact that there is a worst-case scenario and a best-case scenario.
So it requires some sort of medical go forward on it. I mean, people are taking tests all the time.
I can address that. In that document, it states that, A, the PSA, high elevated PSA.
I understand.
But also in the biopsy instructions, it states avoid heavy lifting. Remember, one of the reasons why he left that day was because he wanted to avoid the heavy lifting that he didn't get.
He didn't say that, though.
Did not say that.
No, he didn't say that.
He said it the day before. He said, I'm supposed to avoid heavy lifting, and his supervisor said, try it, see what happens, which he did. He tried it. Next day he came back and had the
I'm sick, I want to go home.
Obviously, the recovery aspect. But I do want to point out something in counsel's brief, the defense brief. They point to the Lackey decision and references made there with regard to the Senate report. And the Senate report clearly makes certain that an individual can take time off, not because he's seen a doctor, but for recovery purposes. And I believe 114 of the regulations state that you don't necessarily have to see a doctor to have time off. You can have time off for recovery or for the reasons, as Mr. Burnett indicated here. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wharton. Thank you very much, Mr. Fowler. The case will be taken under advisement. This court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30, and thank you all.